Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 15th of June. This Friday marks the 40th anniversary of the War on Drugs. On the morning of June 17, President Richard Nixon declared America's public enemy number one in the U.S. is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage an all-out offensive. Our guest this hour says, going back to Nixon's period as president, we were losing the Vietnam War, and he fortuitously decided to declare all-out global war on the drug menace, and he was going to eliminate it and created the Drug Enforcement Administration, starting this huge bureaucracy. Since that time, our guest says, we have spent at least $200 billion in taxpayers' dollars. We have caused the murders of hundreds of thousands of Americans, many of them totally innocent. We have racked up, we have tripled virtually the property crime rates. We have doubled the violent crime rates in this country since Nixon declared war. Professor Stephen Duke teaches and writes on criminal law, criminal procedure, evidence, and drug policy at Yale Law School. He is the author of Mass Imprisonment, Crime Rates, and the Drug War, a Penological and Humanitarian Disgrace. He's also co-author of America's Longest War, Rethinking Our Tragic Crusade Against Drugs, and he has written and spoken widely on this topic. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we look at the war on drugs this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Stephen Duke, thank you very much for being with us.
You're most welcome.
Do you think the president, President Nixon, started this war as a distraction from the Vietnam War?
One could suspect that, yes. He may have thought that this is a war he could win.
The amount of money that we have spent in 40 years is just astronomically high. Where has all that money gone?
It's gone into building of prisons and payrolls for drug agents and useless programs to try to deter people from using drugs.
You talked in a recent interview about the number of people who have been murdered. This is a really sensational statement. We've caused the murders of hundreds of thousands of Americans, many of them totally innocent, as a result of the war on drugs. How so?
Well, a major cause of homicide in the United States is related to the illegal drug business. People who compete for territories, that is, distributors of the drugs compete for territories. They often kill each other over those territorial claims. They kill each other stealing money or drugs from each other. They kill bystanders just by accident. Those are the primary murders that occur in the course of the black market, black marketing of illicit drugs.
Are we targeting in this war certain kinds of drugs?
Well, yes. There are certain, only certain drugs are in fact prohibited, and we're targeting those drugs. That I suppose the four main drugs that have occupied the drug warriors in the last 40 years are opiates, primarily heroin, cocaine, marijuana, and amphetamines. There are many, many mind-altering drugs that aren't even on the prohibited list because they're so rare. They're not seen to be a problem, but there seems to be an almost limitless number of mind-altering drugs that can be consumed by people who are inclined to consume them.
And some of those are prescription drugs, and some of those are some chemicals that are found in household products.
Right, right. All sorts of household products will give you a high of sorts. So will paint and paint remover.
Really?
those drugs, if you want to consider them drugs, are probably more harmful to the user than any conceivable drug on the prohibited list. They're not prohibited. And, of course, they're not prohibited because they have very useful, they're very useful for consequences other than mind alteration, such mm-hmm. as painting houses, things, mundane things of that sort.
Right. What was the goal, and has it changed over the past 40 years? Was it to keep people from using drugs? Was it to keep people from making money off drugs? What was the purpose?
Well, I think the primary purpose, the primary object was to deter people from using the prohibited drugs. If nobody uses them, then that takes care of the black market and the violence and everything else. So I think the hope was that if you punish enough people for using drugs, people will decide to use legal drugs like alcohol and tobacco.
Mm-hmm. And have we been successful in deterring people from using drugs?
Well, I just read a report by the Global Commission on Drug Policy. It came out about a week ago. And in that report, they claim that there is no evidence that drug prohibition has any adverse effect or any effect on people's propensity to consume prohibited drugs. In other words, they've got some evidence that suggests that in places that are not punitive at all about drug use, like the Netherlands, like various other places, Austria or Switzerland, Portugal, most recently, that in those countries the consumption of prohibited drugs is far less than it is here, and indeed in most of them it's less than it was when they were punitive.
That Global Commission called for the ending of the criminalization, marginalization, and stigmatization of people who use drugs but who do no harm to others.
That's a pretty drastic statement.
Yes, it is.
World leaders to make.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a remarkable document given the authors. It doesn't come out for legalization, but it comes out for something very close. In other words, if you're not going to punish the users and the small time dealers, you're only going to punish the criminal organizations and other participants in the black market that use violence. That's a hugely different approach than anything that we've tried in the last 40 years.
There were some pretty high power people on this commission too, weren't there?
Yes, indeed. There were four or five former presidents of countries. There was the Prime Minister of Greece, George Shultz, our former Secretary of State, Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, Paul Volcker, former President of Switzerland. The list goes on and on.
Mm-hmm. The report talks about, and I would like for you to tell us what kind of government, what governments are doing what. They encourage experimentation by governments with models of legal regulation of drugs to undermine the power of organized crime and safeguard the health and security of their citizens. What are various countries doing in terms of legal regulation?
Well, Switzerland, the two most prominent ones, the Netherlands basically, it hasn't legalized the use of marijuana or any other drug, but it de facto has. It allows stores to sell at least marijuana and in some cases harder drugs. It does not punish anyone who possesses or uses the drug. It punishes only the major distributors of the drug. And that has produced a system in which, oddly enough, drugs are not at all popular in the Netherlands. Their consumption rate is far below ours, even though much of their consumption is probably from tourists coming to see, is it really true that right. you can buy marijuana in a coffee shop? Portugal recently decriminalized all drugs, that is, the use of all drugs or the possession of all drugs. And oddly enough, so did Mexico. In the middle of its war, it decided that it would strengthen their effort to win the war against the cartels if they decriminalized the possession and use of drugs and focused their attention on the cartels.
Mm-hmm. And what has that done for drug use and for tackling crime associated with the selling of drugs in Mexico? Has it made a difference?
Well, in Mexico, it's been less than a year since they did that. I don't think we know whether or not it made a difference. Killings in Mexico, which are now, I think they now say 35,000 people.
Goodness.
In the last 4 years. That is an interesting approach, and indeed that, as you mentioned, that is the approach suggested by the Global Commission, decriminalizing minor users or distributors of prohibited drugs. I am not at all sure that that's going to work, because what that does is make the drugs easier to get, legal in effect, and therefore one would expect a greater number of users of these drugs, so that the potential profits in the distribution of drugs in countries that have adopted that approach might be greater than they are now, where everybody is a criminal, from the user on up.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in fact, is the system we had in alcohol prohibition. We didn't criminalize the possession or the use of alcohol during prohibition. We criminalized the distribution of such drugs. We didn't have very good results from that policy in alcohol prohibition, because our crime rates took off, our corruption was unprecedented, and so forth. So while that is certainly an experiment that is worth trying, and so far, Portugal has claims its experiment has worked very well, I have my doubts that long term that approach is going to be as effective as legalization.
So tell me exactly what you would advocate.
I would advocate certainly for marijuana and eventually for any other popular mind-altering drugs like heroin or cocaine. I would recommend that they be regulated much the way alcohol is regulated in the United States. In other words, it's illegal to sell to minors. Only stores that have licenses can actually sell the products. The contents of the products have to meet certain standards. The labeling has to meet certain standards. There have be appropriate warnings on the labels, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, the alcohol industry in this country is very well regulated to protect the health and welfare of consumers, and insofar as possible to deter the use of alcohol by minors, by children. I think that system, while it has some flaws, I think that system is a pretty good model for the way we should handle any other drug.
And yet there will be many who have been victims of drunk drivers or who are noticing, some would say, an increase in underage drinking, that we haven't done a very good job of protecting the health and welfare of American citizens, because use of alcohol is can be damaging to the health and welfare of people. It can hurt their livers. It can kill them. It can kill other people. It can be dangerous.
Absolutely. The last figure I saw was that alcohol kills 100,000 Americans a year, whereas I don't think there's evidence that illicit drugs have killed more than a few thousand, but primarily by overdose, and no evidence that marijuana has ever killed anybody. Now, that's true. We have not done a very good job of regulating alcohol, enforcing the alcohol regulations, but compare the damage that alcohol does now with the damage that it did when it was prohibited. At least there's very little corruption in the alcohol industry. People, when they drink, pretty much know the likely effects of drinking. You don't get any surprises when you buy a bottle of tequila or a bottle of vodka. You know pretty much what you're getting. And probably 100 million Americans drink alcohol on a fairly regular basis. And given that 100 million Americans consume that product on a regular basis, the number of deaths resulting is not so horrendous. It's not so surprising. Tobacco kills 400,000 people a year.
We'll get back to tobacco in a moment. I have questions about that. But, yeah, all of this brings up the question, why do you think we drink so much? Why do we use drugs? Are we unhappy with our existence?
Well, we use them to make ourselves happier or to change our personalities temporarily. A lot of people are shy, and they drink in order to overcome shyness in the social context. Drinking can be soothing. It can help people get over psychological problems of a sort. In fact, there's something innate in not just in the human organism, but in all animals, apparently. All animals, or at least the vast number that have been studied, like to change their consciousness. And animals, most animals, if you induce or introduce them to alcohol, will continue to use it voluntarily.
I was noticing one of the horses, I think it was at the Preakness, the horse's treat was Guinness.
Yes.
I don't know if it made him run faster, it was a reward for running fast or what, but he liked his Guinness. I didn't know that. I didn't know that animals could drink.
Well, somebody wrote a book about that about 15 years ago. I don't remember the title of the book, but that it was a serious scholarly work, and that was a major conclusion.
Hmm. We welcome phone calls. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor Stephen Duke. He's a professor in the Yale Law School, and he writes on criminal law, criminal procedure, evidence, and drug policy. He's the author of a number of books, including Mass Imprisonment, Crime Rates in the Drug War, Penological and Humanitarian Disgrace, co-author of America's Longest War, Rethinking Our Tragic Crusade Against Drugs, and the list of his publications goes on. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. This Friday is the 40th anniversary of the war on drugs. We have spent billions, hundreds of thousands have died, our guest says, and there is question about whether or not this is a policy that's working. The global war on drugs, according to a report of the Global Commission on Drug Policy, which was just released a couple weeks ago, they say that the war has failed with devastating consequences for individuals and societies around the world. So what do you think? To your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls. Victor in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Victor.
Good morning. Good morning to your guests. I'd like your guests to further describe who has a vested interest in keeping the drug war going. I agree that it's been a failure. My concern is the prison population. I'm pretty sure your guest in his book, he cited the fact that it's administered unfairly, especially to blacks, Latinos, or people of a lower working class background who can't afford a lawyer to get them out of prison or to stay their prison sentences when they're tried. And who has a vested interest in this?
Well, surely the prison administration, the people that run prisons, that work in prisons, that build prisons, they all have a vested interest in maintaining the drug war because in some cases the majority of the prisoners are there for drug offenses. In all cases, at least a third of the people in prison are there for drug offenses. So the prison industry, everything associated with prisons, has a vested interest in the status quo. So does the DEA. Their thousands of employees have a vested interest. The police, even the ordinary police in a small town or city have a vested interest because it's so easy to make a drug arrest compared to making an arrest for traditional crime, which requires some investigation typically. Let's say somebody was burglarized. Well, it's unless the burglar fell asleep on the couch where in the place he burglarized, it takes some real work to solve that crime, whereas what the police can make an arrest by simply stopping some youngster, some teenager or young man who's sitting or wandering around in the street, searching and very often finding him in possession of drugs. He could be arrested on the spot. The case can be easily proven. It's just so much easier for the police to enforce the drug laws against the minor users than it is to do typical police work.
Is any of that slacking off because so many states are facing budget problems that they just can't afford to have their prisons as filled as they are?
Well, certainly they're reexamining who they're putting in prison and how necessary it is to put them there or how necessary it is to keep them there. That's a broader problem than the drug problem, but certainly we have had an orgy of sending people to prison in the last 25 or 30 years. For huge sentences, we virtually eliminated the parole process. And at the federal level and in many states. So we've created this huge, the highest prison population per capita in the world by far.
Could you address just a little more fully the racial disparity when it comes to drug sentences and being arrested?
Well, there's the, let's talk about being arrested. In New York City, they arrested over a period of 4 or 5 years, I think it was something like 500,000 people. They arrested on the street under a stop and frisk program, which means basically you just stop whoever you want to stop and you frisk them, and if you find anything interesting, you can reach in and see if it's a gun or a drug. The racial disparity in that program was enormous. I don't remember the exact figures, but it seems to me something like 80% of the people that were arrested in that program were either black or Latino. That's an example of racism at work in the operation of the police.
Victor, thank you very much for your call. Jimmy in La Crosse. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi. It was back in about 1985. My buddy and I were sitting around smoking pot, and he said, you know, all drugs should be legal. I thought he was crazy, but as time has passed, I agree with him. I mean, when drugs are illegal, it heightens the forbidden fruit theory. Curiosity is natural, and when the drugs are illegal, there is little information on how to use them, which leads to experimentation. You're at the mercy of the person who sells the drugs for price, for quality, for quantity, and product dissatisfaction recourse. About a year ago, Joy Cardine on her show had the pot advocate Ben Mazel on her program, and her whole tone was to make Ben Mazel a buffoon. But Ben didn't take the bait, and he was a wealth of information about pot, which he was in his life as well. And as Peter Tosh sings about ganja, legalize it, and I shall advertise it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jimmy. Professor Duke.
Well, I agree with much of what Jimmy said. I'm not sure about this forbidden fruit idea. That is, that by making something illegal, we make it more attractive. A lot of people have bought into that theory, but I just don't know what the evidence is for it. But it does. It is certainly consistent with the findings so far that prohibiting a drug does not apparently deter significant numbers of people from using it. In other words, you can tell people we're going to send you to prison or to jail if you use this drug, and apparently that doesn't keep people from using the drug. So there may be something to the forbidden fruit notion.
Do you have any problems with any drugs being legal? Are there certain drugs that you think are so dangerous they we should just do whatever we can to get rid of them?
Well, I don't know what drug that would be. That is, what natural drug. There are some synthetic opiates that are used for medical purposes, painkilling purposes, that are so powerful that they're highly dangerous to be used recreationally. I suppose I would probably make it illegal to distribute or consume those drugs without a prescription.
What about tobacco?
I do not see. I think we're handling tobacco the way we should handle it. We encouraged the use of tobacco for centuries. We advertised it. We allowed companies to claim that there was not a cough in a carload, and most doctors smoke Camels and that sort of thing. We permitted that false advertising. We can't reverse that. We can't reverse that with prohibition. But what we have done, we've made remarkable progress in reducing the number of people who do use tobacco because we have convinced them that it's dangerous to their health. And we've done studies that prove that tobacco is dangerous to your health. Now, we couldn't have done those studies if tobacco was forbidden. Like, we can't do studies with heroin or cocaine or marijuana. I mean, scientific studies, because that's illegal. Only the government has a monopoly over scientific information regarding prohibited drugs, and it apparently doesn't think it's worthwhile for it to conduct any experiments. But back to tobacco, nobody doubts that tobacco is harmful, not just dangerous to your health, it's harmful. So what we have done is slowly made it more and more difficult to be a smoker. I remember when they forbid the smoking of tobacco on an airliner. A lot of people said, "Well, I'm not going to travel. I can't travel anymore. I couldn't spend 6 hours on an airplane without a cigarette." But what people found out is, well, one way to deal with that is to quit smoking.
Exactly. It's hard to believe that people used to smoke on cigarettes. When you say that, I remember those days. It's just amazing. People would smoke in this little tiny enclosed place where there wasn't much circulation of air.
Yeah, it'd be like a cloud in the whole airplane.
Let's go to Joe in Oshkosh. Hi, Joe.
Morning, Kathleen. Professor, it seems to me that any model for legalization or any practical application of legalization would have to address the issue, not address it actually, but ban outright any kind of advertising and glamorization. And yet, you know, it seems to me that would be a really formidable obstacle here in this country. And in fact, you have many libertarian think tanks, for example, who are all for legalization. When you broach that subject with them, they say, well, of course we have to have advertising. You know, this is a free market system. And yet it just seems inconceivable to me that legalization is going to work if we really do want to decrease the rate of drug use. That we cannot have legalization and or glamorization. I mean, all we need to do is look at tobacco and alcohol as a model. So how are we going to address that?
Well, there are arguments that the First Amendment does not prohibit the condemnation of advertising for unsafe products, but my solution, the solution that Al Gross and I suggested in our book, is really quite simple. We deny any kind of protection for trade names, so that. In other words, you're in the marijuana business, and in order to sell more marijuana, you want to advertise. Well, you don't want to advertise marijuana because that doesn't help you at all. You want to give your marijuana a nice name and then advertise that name as the best marijuana around or whatever, biggest bang for the buck. But you wouldn't do that if the law did not protect your use of that name. Because let's say you wanted to name your marijuana the best taste in town or something like that. Any competitor could adopt that same name and ride free on your advertising. So you would have very little motivation for advertising if you couldn't protect your trade name. And there's no question that trademark protection can be denied to a product. So I think that would solve the answer. You would have maybe a little bit of advertising of the Marijuana Growers Association might want to put out some ad about marijuana, some very loose kind of insignificant, ineffective advertising, like some trade associations do now. But as far as duplicating the kind of advertising that took place in with respect to tobacco, that can easily be eliminated by denying trademark protection.
Thanks very much for the call. How did the Obama administration, considering the fact that this policy, the war on drugs, was started in this country 40 years ago, how did the Obama administration respond to the report of the Global Commission on Drug Policy?
I have not seen a response.
Do you imagine that they're looking at this carefully, do you think? They've got a lot of budget concerns. Congress has got huge deficits to deal with. Would they see this, most of them, as a huge increase in savings?
Obama will probably want to stay as far away from this report as he can, because politically it's not advantageous to suggest either decriminalization or legalization or even a reduction in force of the drug war. No president, Jimmy Carter, when he was running for president, came out for the legalization of marijuana, but no sitting president, that to my knowledge, has ever suggested any reduction in or any alteration in the basic direction of the drug war.
Hmm. I ask you why, but let's go to a caller who wants to address this issue as well. Mark in Door County. Hi, Mark.
Hi, my name is Mark. I used to counsel alcoholics and drug addicts for the Department of Community Corrections, and I agree with you. The war on drugs is failing. We need to keep people out of jail, and those that want to encourage therapy. So how do we increase the public political will? How do we influence public opinion on this issue? How do we develop a strategy for changing this obviously bad policy?
And before we get an answer to that, let me ask you that question in terms of how you counseled inmates on this issue. How did you affect change?
Well, I told them, don't smoke marijuana, because the one biggest side effect, you smoke marijuana, you go to jail.
Mm.
And so I encourage people not to smoke or use marijuana because they would end up in jail or prison. But they would always say, well, why you should legalize marijuana? I said, go. Okay, go. Write a letter. Do something. Organize. But don't tell me that you should be legalizing marijuana while you're smoking marijuana, because you'll go to jail.
Professor Duke.
The basic thrust of Joe's question was, how do we politically change direction? The only politician at the federal level that I'm aware of that has publicly supported any kind of legalization is Barney Frank, who has proposed legalization of marijuana for many, many years. He has this safe place where he doesn't have to worry about reelection. But you can't get a, other than that, you can't get a congressman or a senator or a presidential candidate to admit any doubts about the drug war or any acceptable modifications of our drug war approach, because it's just politically, it's thought to be politically suicidal to do that.
Yeah. What about, well, let's go to more phone calls. Marcel from Green Bay. Hi, Marcel.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right.
I'm talking from a military and a law enforcement background. And in my experience, it really seems as if with the multiple studies that the government has done, most of which fly in the face of the government policy, and now this newest worldwide study, it's really based on finance, economics, dating all the way back to the 20s with the development of the biomass method. Changes happened in World War II, and then after that, more policies were initiated, and that was almost racism when those were done. And you know, when you're on the streets patrolling, and you have dangerous people that you got to deal with, sometimes it's easier just to go after a pothead. Get off, you know, there's not as much danger in that. So I think there's so many different reasons to keep it illegal, financial, you know, with the corporations and especially the oil companies. I can't see it happening myself.
Do you see it happening at some point, Professor Duke?
I think it's inevitable. I've debated people knowledgeable in the field, like the former director of the United Nations studies of drugs and other people of that sort, and they basically say, you're talking about something that is impossible to bring about. It's utterly silly to talk about legalizing drugs in the United States. It's not going to happen. Not going to happen in two lifetimes. That's what the usual approach is. But if you go back to alcohol prohibition, there were people highly placed in the government who said the idea of repealing prohibition is utterly preposterous. It's impossible. One politician said it's as likely as some kind of animal flying to the moon with the Brooklyn Bridge attached to its tail or something like that. And those statements that just said, don't even talk about it, it just can't happen. Those statements were publicly made by prominent politicians within 2 or 3 years of the repeal of prohibition.
Hmm. Interesting. Thanks, Marcel, for the call. Andy in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hey, Andy.
Well, you know, in Edward Gibbon's treatise, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, he marked that the major component was the collapse of civic virtue. And all drugs are, drug usage, as it begins to become more and more widespread, is just one of many symptoms of this collapse of social virtue that this empire, this American empire, is witnessing, number one. Number two is, in Paul's letter to the Romans, it was made very, very clear what happens in that particular case, what happens when empires turn away, you know, from God and virtuous conduct. You begin to collapse and you begin to erode. So what's happening here, whether it's legalized, not legalized, it's a happening, like all these other happenings, to this American empire, the collapse of social virtue. And there's no stopping it. Because once it's going, like it's going full tilt right now, it's very, very hard to reverse. That's basically my comment.
Thank you for the call, Andy. Professor?
Well, I don't think the use of recreational drugs in itself signals any destruction or diminution in the health of the country in which the consumers of these drugs reside. I just don't think there's any evidence of that. There are, for example, Muslim countries where the consumption of alcohol is, in some cases, a capital offense. I don't think that I don't see that particular approach to alcohol is a civic virtue that we ought to adopt here. There are lots of prohibitionist groups, religious and otherwise, and I don't think that they manifest any particular healthy lives or healthy attitudes towards other people. So I just I agree that with the caller that you cannot hope to stop people from consuming mood-altering chemicals, but I don't think it follows from that that's the collapse or signals the coming collapse of the nation or the world.
Thanks, Andy, for the call. 40th anniversary of the war on drugs. We mark it this Friday, and we're asking the question, has it been successful? Our guest says decidedly no. There was also a major report of the Global Commission on Drug Policy, and the members of this commission were pretty high-powered people, presidents of country, former head of the UN, and they said in their report that the war has not gone very well at all. It's failed with devastating consequences, they say, for individuals and societies around the world. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the summer of China, and it starts with the Lakefront Festival of Arts this Friday in Milwaukee. We'll talk about Chinese artists who are going to be exhibiting their work, about the Lakefront Festival and this very interesting exchange program that will not only work with Chinese artists, but also other artists around the world. Ted is our next caller from Minocqua. Hi, Ted.
Hi, how you doing? Your guest just made a couple interesting comments, and one was a little bit ago about being utterly silly to discuss legalizing it in America. And I'm going to be utterly silly because I agree with Jimmy from La Crosse, one of the first callers, that it just should be. And he also just stated that it's hard to stop people from taking these drugs. And I think that's a point that a lot of people miss. There's people that are going to do this stuff, whether it's legal or not. They could make it all legal tomorrow, and between the three of us right here, we're not going to run out and start doing it. So there's a certain percent of people that just do that. And I believe if we were really concerned about the 35,000 murders in Mexico, and this stuff was legal, and it wasn't advertised, and it wasn't promoted, it was just sort of, let's not talk about it, the value would drop so drastically that it wouldn't be worth anything. If people could get it that wanted it, there'd be no market in it for anybody to make money. It would just sort of have to run its course, and it's going to be there anyway. Let's just let it go. I mean, the war on drugs is a complete failure at $1 trillion.
Professor Duke.
Well, I agree with everything Ted said, except that I would add that we can promote people's healthy use of these drugs by regulating their potency and their purity and requiring certain warning labels on the packaging and so forth. All of that we can do only if it's legal.
Mm-hmm. Is there any healthy use of a drug like heroin?
Heroin is a painkiller, very effective painkiller, like morphine. Healthy? I don't know of any healthy. Certainly the field of opiates, of which heroin is kind of on the top of the list, has been enormously important in medical treatment since the invention of it, or the discovery of it, rather, in the 19th century.
On that note, we have to say goodbye. The time has just slipped away. Fascinating hour. Thank you, Professor Duke, for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Professor Stephen Duke, professor of law at Yale Law School, co-author of America's Longest War, Rethinking Our Tragic Crusade Against Drugs. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease as well for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. More conversation following the news.